Good.
Let's see how the light is for reading.
Once more, light.
I'm going to see how it is. Oh, I've got the sunlight. It's fine.
Okay.
Jaya Radha Madhava Jaya Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Jaya Kunja Bihari Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari Yasoda Nandana Prajajana Ranjana Yasoda Nandana Prajajana Ranjana Navanachari Namunatira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Jaya Kunja Bihari Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari Yasoda Nandana Prajajana Ranjana Yasoda Nandana Prajajana Ranjana Amunatira Panachari Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare 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 Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Thank you.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Radha Madhava Radha Madhava Radhe. Jai Radha Madhava Radha Madhava Radhe. Nitya Gaura Hari Bol, Hari Bol.
Kishore Kishori Ki Jai, Jagannath Baladev Subhadra Maharani Ki Jai, Gornitai Ki Jai, all glories assemble devotees, all glories assemble devotees, all glories assemble devotees, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. So today we're continuing the chapter entitled Krishna Chastises the Serpent Kaliya. So that's Canto 10, chapter 16, and the verse for today is text 26. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So, text 26. Evam paribrahma hato jasamunantam sam. Ananyata pritu shiraso adiruda adhya. Tanmurta ratu ratna nikara sparshata tamra. Padambujo kula kaladi guru nanarta. Evam pariprama hato jasamunatam sam. Ananya tat pritu sirasho adiruda adya. Tanmurta ratna nikara svashata tamra. Padambujo kula kaladi gurur nanarta. Evam pariprama hato jasam unnatam sam. Ananya tat pritu shirasho adiruta adya. Tanmurta ratna nikara sparshata tamra. Padambujo kula kaladi guru nanartam. Please chant. Evam paribrahma hato jasam unnatam sam. Ananya tat pritu sirasho adiruta adya. Tanmurta
Tanmuta Ratna Nikara Sparshata Tamra Padambujo Kula Kaladi Guru Nanartha Evam Pari Brahmahato Jasamanatam Sam Ananya tat pritu siraso adirutajyam Tamuta ratna nikara sparshata tamram Padambujo kula kaladi guru nanartam Evam pari brahmahato jasamunatam sam. Ananya tat pritu siraso adirudajyam. Tanmuta ratna nikara svashita tamram. Padambujo kula kaladi guru nanartam. And the word for word, evam, in this way, Paribrahma, because of the Lord's moving around him, hata, spoiled, or just some, whose strength, unmata, raised high, amsam, whose shoulders, ananya, making him bend down, tat, his, vetu sirashu, onto the broad heads, adirudaha, having climbed up, Ajya, the ultimate origin of everything, Tat, his, Murta, on the heads, Ratna Nikara, the numerous jewels, Sparsha, because of touching, Ati Tamra, very much reddened, Pada Ambuja, whose lotus feet, Akila Kala, of all arts, Adiguru, the origin, spiritual master, Nanarta, began to dance. So, this tremendous translation. Having severely depleted the serpent's strength with his relentless circling, Shri Krishna, the origin of everything, pushed down Kaliya's raised shoulders and mounted his broad serpentine heads. Thus, Lord Krishna, the original master of all fine arts, began to dance. His lotus feet, deeply reddened by the touch of the numerous jewels upon the serpent's heads. Purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Sri Hari Vamsa states, Shiraha Sakrishno Jagraha Sva Hasena Vananamya. Translated, Krishna grabbed Kaliya's head with his hand and forced it to bow down. Closed inverted commas, so end of translation. Most people in this world are quite reluctant to bow down to the Supreme Person, the Absolute Truth. In the contaminated state called material consciousness, we conditioned souls become proud of our insignificant position and are thus reluctant to bow our heads before the Lord.
Yet just as Lord Krishna forcibly pushed Kaliya's head down and thus defeated him, the Supreme Lord's energy in the form of irresistible time kills all conditioned souls and thus forces them to bow down their arrogant heads. We should therefore give up the artificial position of material life and become faithful servants of the Supreme Lord, enthusiastically bowing down at his lotus feet. Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur explains that Lord Krishna's lotus feet became red like copper because of their contact with the numerous hard jewels upon the heads of Kaliya. Lord Krishna, with those glowing reddish feet, then began to demonstrate his artistic skill by dancing on the unsteady moving surface of the serpent's hoods. This extraordinary demonstration of dancing skill was meant for the pleasure of the young woman of Vrindavan, who, at this phase of their relationship with Krishna, was seriously falling in love with him. Om Gyana Timurandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshurin Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manopistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yutapadakamlam Shri Guru Vaishnavam Shri Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakha Vitamscha. Hey Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bando Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Tapsa Kanchana Gorangi Radhe Vrindavanishvari Vrishabhanu Sutadevi Pranamami Hari Priye Panchakalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyascha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnebhyo Namo Namaha Namo Om Vishnu Padai Krishna Prasthai Bhutale Shrimati Rompadaswami Tinamine Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Tinamine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paschaja Deshatarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Now, there's a commentary by Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur in Sarata Darshini on this particular verse where he makes a comparison. So the comparison is that Krishna dancing on the hoods of the Kaliya serpent, it's comparable to a very skillful dancer who displays his dancing skill by choosing to dance on different objects. So the example he gives is a dancer who chooses to dance on plates. So, by mounting Kaliya's broad heads, Krishna begins to dance on a very unsteady moving surface. So there's hoods of the serpent, they're moving around, and Krishna's dancing, managing to dance on that unsteady surface. So I guess comparable to dancing on plates that, you know, are fragile. One has to have quite a bit of skill not to destroy them. And in Krishna's case, the skill that's required is due to the movement and the unsteady surface, that he has to have sufficient agility and control to be able to retain his balance. one of the characteristic qualities of Krishna is that he's artistic. So that's one of the listings of his, one of his qualities. And that quality is defined
as the ability to talk and dress himself very artistically. And the word that's used in Nectar of Devotion is vidagdha. So this characteristic of being artistic, and it's visible in his personality, it also extends to his dancing. So it's not merely the being able to dress very beautifully or talk very wonderfully, articulate beautifully, but it also extends to his movement, his dancing, and his playing an instrument. So the fact that Krishna has a flute, it has to do with that particular characteristic or quality of his being very artistic. I mean, there's a certain beauty to holding a long, thin instrument. The fingers have to be positioned in a certain way, so one gets to see the beauty of the fingers being positioned a certain way. And of course, there's the beautiful sound that's coming out. and Srimati Radharani bears this out all in one statement that she makes regarding Krishna's artistic quality. So this is quoted in Nectar of Devotion, which Srila Prabhupada summarized from Srila Rupa Goswami. So this is her speaking, highlighting this artistic quality of Lord Krishna and how it extends across the board, the dressing, the movement, the speech. So here's Srimati Radharani talking. So she's talking to a fellow gopi. My dear friend, just see, Krishna has nicely composed songs and he dances and speaks many words and plays on his flute wearing nice garlands. He has dressed himself in an enchanting way, as though he had defeated all kinds of players at the chessboard. He lives most wonderfully at the topmost height of artistic craftsmanship. So this is how she sees it. She considers Lord Krishna to be at the height of artistic craftsmanship. So any art form, there's a craft connected to it. I don't play madanga, but I know that one has to learn rhythms, one has to learn ragas, the appropriate sounds for particular times of day. So there's a whole craft to the art form. And one has to learn that craft in order to then be able to express with the emotion that's coming from oneself and the movements that go along with that craft. So, of course, certain persons will have more artistry connected to how they use the craft and how they use it for self-expression or expression in relation to Krishna and worship to him. So by way of a devotee talking, this pastime that's taking place in this very artistic manner, it's expressed, and now there's a devotee who's written called Kalakanta Das, and he's written a very beautiful book entitled appropriately, The God Who Dances. So I'm going to read a little extract where he's put in poetic form, so 8 lines of a poem that expresses this particular pastime and summing of the artistry. So also looking at how a devotee worshipping Lord Krishna has also that quality of artistry in terms of using the craftsmanship connected to poetry to encapsulate this pastime. So I'm going to read his writing or his poetry. So here goes. Despite the fearsome sight, Lord Krishna danced around in play. The evil serpent tried to bite, but Krishna danced away. Like Garuda who plays with snakes before they are devoured, Lord Krishna played with Kaliya, who slowly lost his power. The endless circling left Kaliya's energy in shreds, and Krishna seized the opening to climb upon his heads. The master of all arts, Lord Krishna, whirled and danced around, his feet made red by rubies set within Kaliya's crown. So that's a devotee being artistic, using the craftsmanship of poetry to describe this pastime. So thus it is that as Kaliya and Krishna moved in a circle, the serpent gradually became very fatigued and his strength seemed to diminish considerably. And Krishna immediately, when he saw that the strength had diminished, so there's a certain amount of energy that one has to utilize to mobilize one's body. So unless vigorous exercise is preceded by a good amount of rest, one may run out of energy somewhere through the vigorous exercise. So in the case of Kaliya, he's having to move all his 100 hoods around Krishna and having to also use energy to see how he's going to find an opportunity to bite Krishna. So Krishna keeps him circling and the motion tires him out considerably. So it's at that moment that Lord Krishna presses down his hoods. And so he's on top of the hoods, or just prior to his coming on top of the hoods, he presses down the hoods with his hand and forces Kaliya to bow down. So always the head, when we bow down, the head is bowing down in submission because that's the intelligence that's there. So one is using all one's intelligence and putting it in the lowest position, close to the ground, to indicate one's submission. So in the same way, Kaliya does that. And in the purport, there's mention that most people in this world are reluctant to bow down, are reluctant to put their head in the lowest position possible in submission to Lord Krishna. And the reason for this being the case is that persons are acting from the ego such that the acts that they're performing and the mental states are that they're recognizing in relation to themselves are related to the concepts that they're holding of themselves. So that's the ego functioning. There's an introspective recognition in relation to the concept one holds of oneself. So one can only perform an action if it's in accord with the concept that one holds of oneself. So if that concept that one is holding is that one oneself is this form that one's inhabiting, this material body, then it's very difficult to mobilize this material body to be submissive to somebody else or a greater being, because one is still seeing everything of oneself just in relation to this material physical form. And if one takes it a bit further, from the psychoanalytic point of view, the ego is that part of the psyche which experiences the external world through the senses. So this is psychoanalytic point of view. It experiences the external world through the senses, and it organizes thought processes and governs action. So this is a psychoanalytic point of view. And one of the proponents of psychoanalytic theory, because this is a great influence in Western thinking, the psychoanalytic point of view, even with this understanding that there's an ego aspect, so a subtle component within this material body, where a person is experiencing the external world is actually then taking in the information through the senses, and he's organizing everything within a view, creating a view of himself as he's taking in this information. Psychoanalytic theory, and particularly Jung, who's a proponent of this, says that even with that happening, the person remains an enigma to himself. So he still actually is, what he is still really unknown to him. This is, even Jung is recognizing that. So the ego is holding a certain concept. I mean, Srila Prabhupada, in conversations where a devotee is placing the teachings of Freud in front of Srila Prabhupada and breaking it down step by step, he points out that Freud is thinking of himself as an Austrian. So, it means in relation to the material body. And Jung has gone a little bit further, where he actually says that even with the ego holding concepts of oneself, there's still the self, so to speak, is undiscovered, or it's an enigma to the person. So this is interesting. And I'm going to look at his analysis, because this influences so much of Western thinking. His analysis is that man knows how to distinguish himself from animals. From the point of view of anatomy or physiology, it's very obvious. But because he's a conscious feeling being, he's gifted with something unusual, and that is speech. And he lacks criteria for self-judgment. So this is the writing of Jung. So what he's indicating is that some knowledge of who one actually is, self-knowledge, it actually requires some comparison with some other being who's also got the ability to speak, or also has the ability to reflect internally. So obviously, man can't, if he's comparing himself with animals, in this world, he's just going to be comparing himself on the physiological level or the anatomical level. But that still leaves this problem. What is he going to compare himself to get a different sense of himself? It requires comparison to some other being who has abilities that he has, particularly the one of speech or reflection or introspection. So for Jung, he just comes down to saying, well, you know, humans needed to clarify certain concepts that they held regarding the solar system, so they required Copernicus to solve that problem. So in the same way, the psyche needs somebody to clarify it, basically. So he's sort of doing that in his, from the psychoanalytic perspective. And the conception that's usually held is that the psyche is some sort of epiphenomenon of the brain. Because everything's physiological, remember, that's the Western viewpoint. So even something subtle like the psyche is just seen as an epiphenomenon of the brain. So now, I've gone into all of this because we're looking at this problem that's presented here of humans having this difficulty to bow down or bow their heads to the supreme absolute truth. Now, Lord Krishna, he gives the means for self-knowledge. So this is what Jung was struggling with, and psychoanalytic theory struggles with. And Krishna puts it this way. He says that one works in a consciousness such that one is conscious of him. So one's conscious of a greater being, a controlling being, rather than acting through the false ego. So the term is false ego because it's not the actual self. But from a materialistic point of view, the ego is dictating how you act, how you see yourself. So if one sees oneself as being superior to another human being, then one might be condescending to the human being that's in an inferior position. It dictates one's actions according to the concepts held in the ego. And Krishna says, if this is the direct statement he makes, if you become conscious of me, you will pass over all the obstacles of conditioned life by my grace. If, however, you do not work in such consciousness, but act through false ego, not hearing me, you will be lost. So, and this is, I guess, the crisis that's there, that even in psychoanalytic theory that's influenced so much of Western thinking, there's this understanding that somehow there's a problem, that to really get at the self, one needs a reference point. And that's the difficulty. Unless you hold a concept of a greater being who, you know, has the ability to speak, has the ability to introspect, you are pretty much stuck with your ego and how you, the picture you've formed of yourself. And I'll read that particular verse, that's because it's so significant to our discussion. Machitaha Sarva Durgani, Mat Prasadat Tarishyasi, Ata Chetvam Ahankaram, Nas Sroshyasi Vinanksyasi. So Srila Prabhupada explains that the person who's got learned behavioral patterns, because this is what starts happening. One's functioning with one's the concepts one holds, and also learning starts to take place. One starts to develop patterns of thought or external patterns of behavior. And in fact, one gets carried away by the false ego. This is Srila Prabhupada saying, meaning that the concepts one holds of oneself in relation to one's body cause one to get a bit carried away by the false ego. So perspective gets lost. And it also means that one's world is pretty narrow, because it's very much centered on that the ideas of oneself that are in the ego. And by being conscious of Lord Krishna, then one comes to know how to act, because one's seeing the world in relation to having a master. So one comes to know what needs to be done and what doesn't need to be done, because the means for making a judgment for one's action, it's actually prompted by Krishna. And the understanding is that he's actually present within. So actually one's actions get prompted by him from within. And that action also gets confirmed by an external authority who's realized in relation to Lord Krishna, and that's the spiritual master. So you can see how subtle and extraordinary it is taking to Krishna consciousness. And there's another way to put it, and Srila Baladev Vijayabhusan, he spells it out from another angle. So exactly this idea that I've been expressing, he expresses it. So he's talking as though he's Krishna. So, or not that he's Krishna, but he's putting out Krishna's words. So Srila Baladev Vijayabhusan, as though Krishna's talking. But if you do not hear what I have said, and because of thinking that you know what is to be done and what is not to be done, so the ahankara, the false ego, you will deviate from your goal of self-knowledge. So there exists no one other than I among living beings who knows what is to be done and what is not to be done. Only I know what is beneficial. So this is Srila Baladev Vidyaboo's son speaking Krishna's words in a more simple way. So you can see the problem if one takes it that Krishna's stating that he's the only being who knows what needs to be done and what is not to be done, and you've got a whole population of persons, say, in our part of the world, that's influenced by psychoanalytic theory, that actually one does according to the concepts one holds in one's ego. It's a pretty dark existence. Now, going back to Jung, he writes that there's been downright resistance to the mere possibility of there being a second psychic authority. So this is a psychoanalyst writing, besides the ego. It seems a menace to the ego because it's a challenge to the monarchical position that's present in the ego. So this is Jung writing. It's very difficult. The ego sees itself as the ruler. So to actually consider the possibility that there might be another psychic authority, it's a challenge to the ego. But he goes a little further because he has to look at religion and where religion comes in. So as he puts it, religionists are accustomed to the thought of not being the sole master in his house. And the religious person believes that God decides and not he himself. So this is a very interesting jump that happens with persons who at least take to a religious process. They actually, they have some ease with accepting this idea that they're not the sole master in their physical form. And actually they believe that God decides and not they themselves. So immediately a distinction can be made between those just merely influenced by the current thinking and remaining on the ego plane and those that at least take to some religious process. Because there's that acknowledgement, oh, there's another master. And I'm looking at all of this because of this problem that's presented in this purport, how it's so difficult to bow down. Most persons being so reluctant to bow down to Lord Krishna. So this means that when one's holding on to an ego that has very materialistic thinking, means there's that sense of identifying with material things, with matter. It means that the concepts that are held are grossly self-centered. And they're completely divorced from clear knowledge of the existence of God. And this materialistic ego, it's in turn the cause of further behavioral patterns because a person is connected to possessions. And this means that the person really just continues an enslavement to material consciousness if functioning on this ego plane. Now, in material consciousness or self-centered, egotistic functioning, persons understand that God has a material form. Because remember, they've seen everything through the ego. So if there is going to be another being, a greater being, has to have a material form by which he's visible to the senses. Because that's how the ego is developing its concepts through taking in information from the external material world. so therefore, God too has to be visible to the senses, has to be material. And here's Krishna expressing that idea. It's Bhagavad Gita 7.2. The unintelligent think that the impersonal Atma has manifested an illusory form of myself, They do not know my transcendental existence with form and activities, which is eternal and most excellent, as our Krishna puts it. So he calls his own form eternal and most excellent. So, you know, you can't restrict it and, you know, try and box in the form in some sort of way in relation to the understanding one has of oneself. You know, so I have a material form, God must be material. I'm going to have to face death, God must too. So he actually states that my transcendental existence with form and activities, which is eternal and most excellent. So this is the view, actually, that even, well, one could say somebody with a very impersonal outlook has, that in this particular verse that I'm quoting, that God takes a material form from his original impersonal spiritual form. So there's that idea. So in fact, just going back to Lord Krishna, the statement from earlier on, that unless one is working in consciousness of him, one becomes lost. It's actually only by his mercy, the mercy of the Supreme Lord, that he can be known. So this concept of the Supreme Lord by the self-centered impersonalist, it continues the one where Krishna doesn't have, if he has some form, it's actually come from an original impersonal form. This can continue even if they study a book like Brahma Samhita, where there's, you know, direct descriptions of Govinda eternally existent, which was that definition that Krishna gives of himself. So this ignorance of the personal feature of the Supreme Lord is due simply to ignorance that's coming from the different modes of nature, because persons are getting influenced by their interaction with the material world. So their way of being gets molded in a certain way, and so the concepts they hold within the ego gets molded in a certain way. I'm thinking of some example came to mind. Once I got exposed to somebody who clearly had very, very ignorant interaction with the material world. And so the ego concept was that their whole being self could only be seen in relation to the spouse and the child. That was it. I mean, anything just came back to that's the reality, the ego reality of that entity. And in fact, because the consciousness was in such ignorance, when the person came in front of the deity, so, you know, I get exposed to these things because often I'm in the temple and meet new persons or see new persons. When the conscious, when the that kind of ego concepts being held in the psyche are put in front, the person is put in front of the deities, the person actually was finding fault with Lord Jagannath's appearance. So that's how this kind of very self-centered, egotistical function completely blocks one from understanding that the Supreme Lord has this most beautiful, artistic, eternal form. It has these beautiful qualities. It can't be seen. It's the ego completely blocks. So they cannot see that the Lord has this personal, eternal, spiritual form that's eternally knowledgeable, eternally blissful, and eternally exists. So the reason that Lord Krishna reserves this right of not exposing himself, so to that person he didn't expose himself, is that he's seeing that there's an obstinacy on the part of the person. They wish to remain impersonal. They cannot. So this is this going back to this problem. They cannot. They're extremely reluctant to, you know, bring that psyche in the physical form and put the head on the ground in submission to the Supreme Lord. This particular person took 2 years before the person was able to bow down. I observed it. Just 2 years. So, and here we are waiting for Kaliya's recognition of Krishna, going back to the eternally existent, beautiful form of Lord Krishna with his artistic, agile dancing, balancing himself on this moving surface of 100 hoods. And I'm going to read this beautiful description which highlights the artistry and his complete control of the craft of dancing. Your divine lotus feet, with a glow from the rubies on Kaliya's hoods, I've left out a word here, sorry. Your divine lotus feet shun with the glow from the rubies on Kaliya's hoods as you dance to the songs and music played by your servants, like the Siddhas and the Gandharvas. So this is Srila Sanatan Goswami from Krishna Lila Stava. So, now I'll carry on in a little while. But Lord Krishna appeared to be very cruelly smashing down Kaliya's heads with his feet. Because remember, that's the problem. Can't bow down. But actually, Krishna showed him his greatest mercy. So I'm going to continue. This is Sri Krishna Lila Stava, I think. The demigods delighted in the variety of fast, slow, and medium dances shown by the Lord, as they kept time with the right rhythms. The instruments of the demigods softly sounded, tia ta ta ta, tia tai tai, tai, tu tia ta ta. So of course I'm not a mridanga player, so I may not have the right resonance, so forgive me, I'm reading it as it's written. They also played loud and high-pitched sounds. The demigods brought out newer and newer melodies by combining different notes, sounds, and rhythms. Responding accordingly, Krishna nimbly stepped from one hood of the serpent to another. The demigods could not keep up with the self-styled dancing of Lord Krishna, the supreme controller who moved rhythmically on the hoods of the serpent and expertly danced in such a way to crush and suppress each of his hoods. As the best drum, 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 drimmy, 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 rung, tung, tung, boomed faster and louder, Krishna's brilliance increased more and more as he stomped on the serpent's hoods. So, this is this particular verse. I've stayed very contained with the main idea. If there's some thought on this, please go ahead.
Hare Krishna. What a what an intellectually stimulating and spiritually nourishing class. Really appreciate it. You brought up a point that I've thought a lot about, which is that often I see that people come to Krishna conscious of a certain conditioning, a certain kind of ego conception. And certain people have an ego conception that's very beneficial for spiritual life. They're already quite soft and gentle and accommodating and very positive mindset. And some people like to give the example of this man who couldn't even bow down to the Lord. He was questioning the form of Lord Jagannath. That kind of conditioning isn't the most ideal. Of course, with bhakti, you know, the conditioning is immaterial in one sense. Bhakti can transcend even our conditioning. But still, I see that the conditioning plays a big part. It's not so easy to just kind of, like you were saying, you put it so well, the self is an enigma even to the self. And so we're moving according to our egoic self-conception that we ourselves aren't aware of, you know? And we bring that into the fold of Krishna consciousness. So I was wondering if you could, sometimes I really get this doubt, is bhakti going to alter our conditioning? Like, are we all, at some point, are we just, you know, say I have this mindset where I'm very arrogant and I'm very rude or I'm very like pushy, and then I come to Krishna consciousness. Is it that after 15, 25 years of chanting and serving, that'll change? Because sometimes I see that, at least I look at my own self, I've been around for 10 years, I don't think my conditioning's changed that much. I'm still the same person. I just now want to serve Krishna. You know what I'm saying? And I just, yeah, maybe you could shed some light on this point that I'm, you get what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, the query that's there is, one's coming with the conditioning or the ideas held in the ego, and she was saying, you know, you could get the opposite end of the spectrum that I described or used as an example, where persons may be more in the mode of goodness and more accommodating. But the query that's there is, because bhakti is transcendent to that conditioning or the way of being, be it ignorant or more in the mode of goodness or even passion being controlling, as you said, or pushy, you know, how much does that conditioning change over time? So you're observing yourself and you're thinking, well, you know, I'm still the same person. Now, it's very, very interesting. The path of bhakti, because it's allowing one to understand the self, meaning the spiritual self in relation to Krishna, it indeed is transcendent to the psyche in one sense, because the psyche is something that's been formed over many lifetimes. And in this lifetime, certainly some particular way of being is more prominent. So somebody may be more in the mode of goodness or a little bit more in the mode of passion, although there's a mix, but you can see there's a prominent way of being that's visible. I mean, the very ignorant person, it's extremely visible. I mean, the person even walks in a dejected way or, you know, is statements that come out of the mouth are negative. You know, the world is, you know, is viewed through a whole window of gloom. And the person in the mode of goodness doesn't have difficulty to take up sadhana practices that mean becoming very conscious of the usage of time and keeping things within time frames, not a difficulty. The person in passion, you know, has that need to control. And all those particular ways of being start to get accommodated within the smaller structure of community that is the Sangha of devotees or those attempting to take up the process of bhakti. And it can actually be very interesting where one sees the particular way of being in a very raw state in earlier on and how it evolves over time. So, for instance, I regularly get exposed to a devotee that's very in the mode of passion. So, the person in the mode of goodness wait for the appropriate person to perform a particular service that they usually perform. The person in the mode of passion can't wait, and they'll actually, you know, jump in and perform some act that, you know, kind of causes a bit of disarray, but they feel they've accomplished something because they just cannot wait a minute. They can't wait even 2 minutes for the person to come and do what somebody else who's supposed to do a particular service. So they cause some disruption. And even though it seems very dynamic and energetic, there's disruption. So on a personal level, how the conditioning plays itself out is very intriguing because Krishna speaks about it being his mercy that allows one to come to know him. So how it plays itself out a lot is that he allows one to become aware of the exact way that a particular pattern has formed itself in one's psyche. One starts to be able to objectively see, oh, okay, I see that my thinking goes in a very repetitive way. For some period of time, I'll be in a mode of goodness, and then suddenly I will actually fall into lamentation and, you know, sink into ignorance. And it's a pattern, because after some period of time, I'll go back to goodness. So one starts to see how, and one starts to recognize the way it expresses itself through one's own being. So, and then because one is holding onto the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, one is bowing down one's head to him in submission, one is garnering strength from that relationship that permits one to look more clearly at how those patterns may be affecting others, how those patterns are affecting even one's own satisfaction with one's execution of bhakti, because those patterns start to interfere in some way. So sometimes not grossly, but subtly. You know, one has to deal with, you know, thoughts that are of a particular nature, you know, and they'll come in blocks, chunks, and one has to look at the thought. You know, is this serving a purpose? How can I actually, I want to stop this thought. So let me like examine this. So depending on the makeup one has, I mean, I find with myself, I'm my whole training on a material level has been to look internally, because I studied psychology, so I tend to, you know, go inward and examine things. It may not be the way for everybody, but Krishna allows one at least to see the pattern that one is carrying. And if one is, however, directing one's energy to that process of submission to Lord Krishna, then that starts to override the conditioning. The spiritual strength that's there, that where one's harnessing one's being to perform external actions with the, at least, even if it's sometimes still theoretical, the belief that I am serving Lord Krishna, that has much greater weight, because Lord Krishna is the source of all strength, the controller of everything. It starts to override the conditioning. Override it in terms of that, even if one's conditioning says, I'm so tired from so much thinking or all these thoughts coming, I think I need to rest. But if one's thinking, no, my service is more important, so let me put this aside. I'm going to direct my energy to performing whatever the task is that's for Krishna, then always the victory lies on the side of having directed one's ego, having directed one's being on the side of devotional life. So that is what actually starts getting prominent and, you know, occupies more space in the psyche. And the other starts losing power. That would be a good way to put it. It starts to get weakened. In the same way that Kaliya is getting weakened physically, the psyche, that ego part, starts getting weakened. And one's happy to see it getting weakened because generally it's somehow keeps one trapped in very limiting patterns. So Bhakti allows one to transcend that and grow in strength in a very positive, wholesome way. Because the other's not wholesome. By nature of it being so limited and having been based on incorrect concepts, it's fraught with danger, darkness, and difficulty. So that's a response. Yeah. Thank you very much for your kind attention. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.